Start your day with Morning Edition and wind it down with All Things Considered, only on KPBS. From global headlines to local stories, stay informed, inspired, and connected. Tune in daily or listen anytime at kpbs.org.
Hey there, San Diego. It's time for KPBS Roundtable. I'm Andrew Bracken. ICE detained a Ukrainian woman married to a U.S. citizen late last week after her green card interview. Her detention lasted days, and much of it in the basement of a San Diego immigration facility. We hear about her journey in detention and what it tells us about the Trump administration's ongoing immigration crackdown. Then, with the holiday season in full swing, we hear about some of San Diego's biggest food and drink trends of the year. That's ahead on KPBS Roundtable. Often when we cover immigration, we hear about the statistics and the federal policies behind them. It's rare that we hear the personal stories impacted, especially those that happen right here in our own community. Today, we're talking about one woman's story. Her name is Victoria Bulavina. She's a Ukrainian woman married to a U.S. citizen who was just released after 5 days in immigration detention. KPBS reporter Corey Suzuki joins me now to share more about her story. Welcome, Corey.
Hi, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So tell us about Victoria and how she came to be detained last week.
Right. Well, Victoria arrived in the U.S. in 2022 after fleeing the war in Ukraine. She lived in Kyiv in the northeastern part of the country along the border between Ukraine and Russia, and she ran a business installing window blinds and shades there. And when Russian forces invaded the country and struck Kyiv, Victoria escaped to Italy and eventually moved to the U.S. under a Biden-era humanitarian program called Uniting for Ukraine, which was a form of humanitarian parole. A year later, she met Victor, who is her now husband. Victor has also roots in the city of Kyiv, but he's a U.S. citizen, like you mentioned, and he has lived in San Diego for years. And Victor and Victoria got married. And soon, within that kind of time frame, Victoria also began an application for a green card with the support of Victor, who, again, a U.S. citizen. And USCIS, the agency that processes those applications, set her interview date for this December. And that kind of brings us to what happened last week. So on December 4th, last Thursday, Victor and Victoria show up at the USCIS offices along with a lawyer. Victoria has her interview. Afterwards, the officer asking questions says she needs to step outside. And after a moment, she comes back in with two ICE officers in plainclothes, and they detain Victoria and take her away.
You reported that Victoria and her husband, they'd been concerned about this appointment. Their attorneys had warned them about similar detainments at green card appointments like hers. But why did they think they would be, you know, safe from detention in this case? Can you talk a little bit more about the green card process and where she was in the immigration process when she was detained?
Yeah, I think there are a couple things there. I mean, the green card interview process, just to start, the interview is the final stage of the journey towards getting your green card, which means that you're a permanent U.S. citizen. And Victoria's immigration lawyer told me that everyone who gets to that point has essentially gone through an extensive vetting process and has no record of committing violent crimes, has just had to answer a lot of questions about themselves and what they've done. And the very next step after that interview is becoming a permanent resident. But despite all of that, we have seen in recent weeks here in San Diego, ICE starting to arrest people during or after their green card interviews. That's something that our colleague Gustavo Solis has reported on extensively. And even with all of that happening, it was creating a lot of uncertainty for Victor, Victoria, their lawyers. But Victoria and her attorneys and her family also believed that her legal status had no weak points, that a big argument that our colleagues have reported that federal immigration authorities have made when they are arresting people at these interviews is that they have allowed their legal status to lapse in some way, that they have overstayed their legal authorization.
Maybe
to
a visa expired at some point for some period of time. Right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Which, you know, raises its own questions by itself. But
right.
Victoria's attorneys told me that for her, they say that she has never allowed her legal status to expire at any point since she arrived in the country. And so that really gave them a sense that even with all of this happening, even though it was something that they were worried about, that she was going to be able to go to this interview and to not have to worry about being detained or arrested. And instead, that's exactly what happened.
Right. She was taken into custody on that Thursday. What happened then? Where was she taken? And what were the conditions she was held in like?
Right. Well, for 3 days, and I should say here, we have reached out to ICE with questions multiple times this week. And they have not responded to any of our requests. So what we have is Victoria's account of what she went through. And what she says is that for 3 days, she was held in the lower levels of a federal building in downtown San Diego. She's not sure which one, but some of the descriptions that she shared match reports of people who have been held in the basement of the Edward J. Schwartz Federal Courthouse, which members of Congress have repeatedly tried to inspect this year and were denied access to twice before eventually being able to enter. Victoria says she was held there with between 10 and 14 other women, mostly, she says, from Mexico. And she says it was very cold. There were bright lights all the time. They didn't have room to lie down and sleep. They were given expired food. And they had to she says that she and the women that she was detained with there had to use an open toilet in view of the guards and had to get additional toilet paper. They had to hold up an empty toilet paper roll. So, I mean, just really harsh conditions that she describes. Here's part of what Victoria shared with me during an interview. She's speaking Ukrainian here, and her husband, Victor, is translating.
Вони давали зрозуміти, що я нарушаю закони Америки, і це дуже дуже мене лякало, що я не поверну своє життя.
She felt like she's losing her life. She felt like they were like telling her that she broke the laws of the United States and that she was scared that she would not be able to get her life back.
Wow. I mean, that's just really painful to hear some of that.
Yeah.
I mean, at some point, you kind of described some of her conditions in that facility that in downtown San Diego that we don't exactly know where it is. But at some point, she was moved to a facility in Otay Mesa, right? Or at least like that was another part of this journey. Tell us about that piece of it.
That's right. Victoria says that each night that she was in this facility in downtown for each of those 3 days, the ICE officers every night tried to move her and the other people who were detained there to the Otay Mesa Detention Center, which is, you know, one of the large ICE holding facilities, detention centers here in San Diego to the east of Chula Vista. And the first night, she says, the officers took them out of the holding room. They lined everyone up against the wall, handcuffed their wrists and their ankles, put them in chains, and they had everyone get into this van that was waiting. And Victoria, there were, you know, in these rooms, there were no clocks. There was nothing that she could, no windows, nothing she could use to get a sense of what time it was. But as they got into the van, she saw the clock, and she says it was around 2 a.m. that they left. So middle of the night. They drive to Otay Mesa, from what she says, to the they wait an hour in a line for hours, and then she says that night that morning as the sun was rising, the van, without entering the detention center, turns around and drives back to downtown. So again, this is Victoria's account of what each of those nights looked like. She says that they got no sleep, that they had no access to the restroom, and that they were just in transit in these restraints for hours. And She's still unclear what exactly happened. It seems that maybe there was some kind of a line or a backlog getting into the detention center. She says ICE officers told them that they were taking them to Otay Mesa so that they could have a place to sleep. But instead, they ended up, you know, according to her, not being able to sleep at all. And that happened the first night, the second night, and then the third time that they officers tried to take them to Otay Mesa, they did actually enter the facility.
You know, earlier you mentioned some of the women that Victoria was detained with alongside. Can you tell us more about them and the bond that they developed over the course? And I imagine a lot of times they couldn't even communicate. They didn't even speak the same language, right? But can you tell us more about their experiences? Because this is, you're telling Victoria's story here, but the big point of it is it's not just one person's experience right now.
Right. Victoria and Victoria herself, she, in our conversation, her husband was translating. She understands English. She doesn't speak it as fluently. So she speaks primarily Ukrainian. And in her, the memories of what happened, she says that the other women who were, who she was held with, there were kind of a large range of people. At the Otay Mesa Detention Center, there was a larger number. She says they were between 18 and all the way as old as, some people as old as 80. And that in both places, they were from different countries. Again, she says she met a lot of people from Mexico who had roots in Mexico. She says she met one person who had roots in Thailand. She says at Otay Mesa that she met someone too, I believe multiple people who also had roots in Ukraine as well. And I mean, just like you said, the bond that she describes between herself and all of these other people who were experiencing these same conditions was a huge part of what she shared. In the lower level facility, she says she and other detainees tried to help each other, trying to get each attention for people who were having medical issues. When someone had to use the toilet, the other women would form a wall around them to give them some privacy, even just sort of huddling together to try and keep warm in the cold and without blankets or other sources of warmth. And she also said that at one point she and other detainees talked about the future and what they would do when they got out, and saying that they maybe they would all meet at a restaurant and share a meal somewhere together in another time, another place.
What do you think Victoria's experience can tell us about the larger picture of immigration enforcement today?
Well, you know, I'm new to covering immigration. Normally, I'm the South Bay and Imperial Valley reporter here at KPBS, and you know, I focus on local government and environmental issues, and it's a very regional beat. But I mean, as someone who, you know, at the same time is, hearing and seeing so much of the news around immigration, I think that Victoria's story really raises a lot of questions, both about what she went through and also how the federal government is treating everyone else that she described who is still being held in these facilities. And that's exactly what her attorney, Caroline Matthews, told me, actually. Victoria's immigration lawyer works for a nonprofit law clinic in San Diego called Pathways to Citizenship. And she says that Victoria's experience is emblematic of many more people. Here's a little bit of what she told me.
This error is happening repeatedly. This isn't the only person this is happening to. So that suggests to me, and I'm seeing firsthand, that there is a system in place that is putting arrest and detention numbers ahead of accuracy.
So Victoria ultimately was released, right? But where does her case stand right now, and what's next for it?
That's right. And I think that's one big open question that we still don't quite know yet. Victoria and her family are focused now on trying to continue the green card process and get secure that hopefully that permanent residency. Her attorney also says that there are still active pending removal proceedings against her. And so that's kind of an open question of what that means. And broadly, too, I think what we're seeing is that NPR has reported this week that the agency even handling these cases, USCIS, which oversees citizenship and immigration cases, is increasingly being sort of turned to focus by the Trump administration on law enforcement and on removing people from the country. And so I think we're still in the middle of this process. That's what Victoria's attorney told me, that this is she's released, and that's that they are all feeling very happy about that and glad that she is out of the detention system. But that also this is in some ways a halfway point, and it's not clear yet.
It's not over
what,
yet.
What happens next? Yes.
Earlier, you know, you touched on Victoria and some of the women she met, how they kind of, you know, worked together in detention and their desire to reunite at some point. I'm just curious, you know, has she had any contact with them? Has she heard anything about, you know, their status right now?
You know, not that I know of so far. I texted with Victoria's husband, Victor, yesterday, and he said that she's sort of still recovering and trying to get back to some sense of normal. But Victoria says that she is still thinking about all of these people, all of these women especially. And her family has talked about trying to figure out what they can do to help them. So I think that, you know, that's another open question about what comes next for Victoria and for her family.
I've been speaking with KPBS South Bay and Imperial Valley reporter Corey Suzuki. You can read more of his reporting on Victoria's story at kpbs.org. Corey, thanks so much for sharing more about this important reporting with us today.
Thanks for having me, Andrew.
When Roundtable returns, we'll talk a little bit about some holiday food and drinks coming up next.
KPBS On Demand is supported by UC San Diego's Art Power, presenting Good Writing, an evening with Anne Lamott and Neil Allen at the Balboa Theater on April 1. Tickets at artpower.ucsd.edu.
Welcome back to KPBS Roundtable. I'm Andrew Bracken. Though it may not come with December snowfall or a need for scarves and mittens, San Diego does celebrate the holidays, albeit in its own style. And one way we celebrate is with food and drinks. Today, some ideas for where to celebrate this season, and we take a look back on some of San Diego's biggest food trends in 2025. Joining me today are Jackie Bryant. She is a San Diego journalist and host of the Happy Half Hour podcast. And Helen Huang is also here. She is a food and travel journalist in San Diego. I want to welcome you both to Roundtable. So holiday season, it's like fully in effect by now. This week, I saw my first, like, trolley bus taking a tour of holiday lights around town. That's the signal for me. Jackie, one thing when I think about the holidays, you know, family traditions are a big part of it, and food traditions. You know, do you or your family have any particular San Diego food traditions that you look forward to?
We do. It might be a little obvious and a little boring, but we like to go to the Dell. I'm from the East Coast originally. I've been out here for 10 years. My husband is not from here. We have a young son. And I mean, if you are doing Christmas in San Diego, the Dell obviously activates for you. They've got the rink. They've got Santa. They did that $550 million renovation that was completed earlier this year. So they've got a lot of new restaurants, but they trick it out for Christmas. And so for me, my family's coming in from the East Coast. We're going to spend a few days there around Christmas. We are just very stereotypically San Diegan. They provide it all.
And the Dell to me is like the pinnacle of like traditional, you know, holiday season in San Diego that I can think of. Helen, you've lived in many different cities. You've covered, you know, other cities in your travel writing. What stands out to you about San Diego when it comes to the holidays?
Well, I love the fact that we're so close to the beach as well. So like we incorporate like a Christmas beach walk. And generally, I am doing the cooking, like we are all doing the cooking, and we love to do rack of lamb. And I think that's left over from our British, my husband is from England, and we lived in Scotland for 8 years. And then they definitely do Christmas in a different way. Which,
well, Helen, you know, another part of, you know, the holidays come with these holiday-themed drinks, whether it's just going to Starbucks, but also a lot of bars, you know, cocktail bars and stuff do certain special things. You recently profiled some holiday pop-ups. Can you tell us more about, you know, how a pop-up works first?
Well, basically, it's a temporary experience that definitely decked out for the holidays, for Christmas, and transports you to a different feel for time and place. So one of the ones I covered was the Golden Girls Christmas pop-up, which is definitely nostalgic. You know, I think they're celebrating their 40th anniversary of the sitcom. And I think that we're seeing a trend for nostalgic times. Even Duck Dive in Pacific Beach has this great Dickens pop-up, and they've been doing that for years, and it's super fun with, you know, Charles Dickens and Scrooge, and they're actually playing, like, British holiday music.
Wow. Like, Jackie, I mean, yeah, how does this nostalgia show up for you and kind of San Diego's food and bar scene this year?
Well, building on the pop-up trend, for me, there's a lot of nostalgia plays in there. I feel like, especially in the age of social media and Instagram, holiday pop-ups are a great way for restaurants to really do it up and get some extra attention around the holidays. And so there's one really nostalgia-tinged one that I love. It's the Emo Christmas at El After in the Gas Lamp. And so if you can, if anyone who's middle-aged right now, you know, came of age in the early aughts can get there with me, you're in your parents' basement. Maybe they had a finished basement that still looks kind of 70s, and you're playing screamo, emo, anything that was on rock radio at the time.
Wearing tight black jeans, maybe?
Exactly. Maybe some black eyeliner. Maybe you have some Hot Topic hair dye. I don't know what's going on. But it's also decked out like Christmas, so you can go and listen to your favorite emotional rock songs from your early life while also just getting in the holiday spirit. So that's a really cool one.
Pretty unique, yeah.
Yeah, they're snowed in at Fort Oak in Mission Hills. And so they've turned that whole front center of their bar that used to be an old Ford dealership, so it's just paneled windows all the way around. They basically turned it into a snow globe. I don't know if it gets more nostalgic than that, than going to drink inside of an actual snow globe. So that's a very, very cool one. And then there's Yoho Holiday Tavern at the Land Shark in the new Margaritaville Hotel in Mission Bay. So that's just another way that San Diegans can do Christmas in a different nostalgic way. Get your parrot head on. Obviously vibes with the very hot weather that we're having now thanks to the Santa Anas. So,
right.
Yeah, so I actually think pop-ups do a great job of bringing nostalgia into Christmas because they can bring like a fleeting moment or memory and get people really into the season. And then it's gone, just like the holidays.
Yeah, Jackie, what do you look for in picking a holiday bar? What are some of the key elements other than, you know, some of the traditional fare you go to? What else do you look for?
Honestly, I think there's got to be a really strong no alcohol element. Surprisingly, maybe. I think a lot of people are reevaluating their drinking at this point in history. Again, I am middle-aged. I'm 40. I know a lot of my contemporaries are evaluating their health in that way. And Gen Z, I teach at San Diego State University. It's very clear that a lot of my students just don't really drink at all. When I used to be at San Diego Magazine, we did a story about Gen Z and how they're not really drinking as much alcohol. So I think bars have had to reimagine their offerings, and I think the pop-ups and all the decorations are actually part of what's bringing people in for a full experience rather than maybe just the specificities of the drink menu. You want to provide something for everybody. So I think no alcohol is actually a huge theme. You can pretty much walk into any really good bar or restaurant with a pro cocktail program these days and ask for a very well-crafted non-alcoholic drink. So for me, I'm not drinking much at this phase in my life. I want to make sure that the environment is providing like a full 360 experience
for
the holidays.
It's not just about the drink itself.
Exactly.
It's about, yeah, Helen, does that, yeah, are you seeing that as well?
Yeah, definitely. And then you see some like really ambitious restaurants that are also offering non-alcoholic cocktail pairings, non-alcoholic beverages at, I think, Lilo and Addison. They are on Florette. They are doing non-alcohol. And even the welcome cocktails for the holidays, are they can choose between champagne or non-alcoholic champagne. So
I think that's actually just like a big trend in general for this year, because I've talked to a lot of bar owners specifically, and they said that it's very hard to get people in the door these days and stay there. And when they are there, they are just – there's not as many drink tickets, even if there's live entertainment or what have you. So I actually think that that's – it's just a big operating challenge for bars and restaurants this season. So I think many of them are just pulling out the stops to get people in the door. And these really big, festive things are part of it. I think also just being cozy. Like, obviously, you're going to blow it out, but it has to be cozy, too. I was just at the University Club, for example. And this isn't necessarily made public, but there is a very well-heeled member there who throws her Christmas party every year, and she allows the club to keep the decorations up for a couple of weeks around the season so that anybody coming in to enjoy them. So if you go through to the University Club right now, there's, like, this incredible decoration tunnel. There's a British, you know, red phone booth in there. There's a Santa outpost. It's very decked out. So obviously, I think maximalism is kind of required, but there has to be an element of coziness. It has to be recognizable for people. And bottom line, it has to provide an experience.
Well, you know, Helen, one holiday pop-up that you recently mentioned in one of your write-ups was actually a tiki-themed bar, the Grass Skirt, and a pop-up they're doing. I mean, that caught my eye as something that's kind of particularly San Diego. I mean, tell us about that.
Well, the Grass Skirt is it's such a cute little place, and it's always a tiki bar, but they're doing a sippin' Santa cocktail experience right now. So Santa on a surfboard and things like that, but it's also combined with all their tiki cocktails. And but I will say Sipping Santa is national, but Grass Skirt, among other tiki bars, or in San Diego, it's a particular trend that I think Jackie could speak more about.
We have a very storied tiki culture here in San Diego. So tiki goes back to the World War II era, specifically in Hollywood and Oakland, where the first two bars were founded by Trader Vic's and Don Beach founded the other one. And then Bally High was opened here in 1952 by the same, it changed hands shortly after to the family that still owns it, but the original family was involved. And it was originally called Christian's Hut, which was a restaurant that they used on the set of the Mutiny of the HMS Bounty, the MGM production. It was filmed here, that was part of it. And then after filming stopped, Bally High became Bally High, and it is really the reason why there is tiki culture here in San Diego today. And so out of that whole apparatus, the family that's involved in it is very involved in tiki culture around the world. They helped bring Tiki Oasis here to San Diego, where it's been for decades, based at Town and Country. And then 2000...
That's like a convention, right?
Yes, exactly. Oasis is an international convention. People fly in from all over the world. They get individual rooms and parts of the resort and just basically build their own little tiki bars and tiki installations. And so that's a big draw for that culture here. And in 2016, we saw a modern revival. CH Projects opened up False Idol, and SDCM opened up The Grass Skirt. And those opened actually in the same month. It was October 2016. And since then, there have been a number of tiki speakeasies, pop-ups, standalone bars, and you can all count that as that modern wave of this continual culture that has always been very, very strong here. The tourism culture supports that. We're not a tropical region, but because we have palm trees and the beach, I think visitors come here expecting that, right? And so it's a culture that has kind of died out elsewhere, even in the cocktail revival, but it's always been very strong here. And I think it's the combination of just the natural geographic environment, the fact that we're a tourism town, and, just that cocktail culture revival also helped it too.
Helen, we all know San Diego is not a cheap place to live, so I wanted to kind of call out and see if you had any tips for, you know, experiencing the holidays without spending too much this holiday season.
I think... another holiday tradition is going down to Convoy District and spending, getting a Chinese dinner. And there's a number of restaurants down there, like Dumpling Inn and
Spicy City is always packed out.
It's always packed
on Christmas Day. Yeah.
Yeah. And dumplings, like China Max is one of the a big one that can accommodate people, Jasmine. So that's been a tradition, I think they would say, like a Chinese and Jewish tradition to avoid the whole hoopla.
During the holidays, and, yeah.
So, but I think that's also like spreading out to other places like Glass Box and one in Skydeck in Del Mar or Carmel Valley, things like that. So I think that's one way to handle the holidays.
Also, probably the other downtowns around the country, like El Cajon, and obviously you have 3rd Street in Chula Vista, and you've got all the other downtowns. They all kind of get decked out for the holidays. They all have their little parades and installations and their local storefronts and local restaurants that have all kinds of different specials. So, like some of the big, fancier ones, everyone is getting decked out for the holidays. And the same as Thanksgiving, like hotels are a really good place to do that. And though the offerings may be a little more expensive there, they tend to do packages. So it's a good way to get a bang for your buck because they anticipate families coming. They anticipate the needs of families and the things that you'd want to have wrapped in, like Santa, for example, or something like that. And so hotels are a good place for the budget conscious just to look to make sure that you spend – you know, you spend your money once and you're not going to be constantly opening your wallet the whole time.
And I know you've also talked about just hotels as being such a great source of great restaurants here, Jackie, in San Diego. Are there any other ones that you'd suggest folks might want to check out?
Yeah, definitely. So the Gaylord Pacific Resort, which opened this year on the Chula Vista waterfront and is actually the most expensive hotel project ever constructed in California. So Old Hickory Steakhouse there is serving a 3-course Christmas dinner. They've got spiny lobster, roasted quail, goose cassoulet, filet mignon. It's pretty legit. They've apparently decked out. I haven't seen it, but they have decked out the whole thing for the holidays.
Yeah. I used to live outside Nashville and going to the Gaylord for Christmas was a thing that everybody did. And it was the Gaylord in Nashville. Yeah. Like it was just everything that people had to do at the holidays.
Well, there you go.
So I'm planning on going there this Sunday and hopefully it will live up to my expectations from
That's so cool.
I'm sure it will.
Yeah. I didn't know that was like another regional tradition. That's really cool.
Well,
yeah. You've got the Lafayette. In North Park, they've got holiday tea service, winter cocktails. If you've even peeked inside the lobby, it is completely, it is a Christmas fever dream. Obviously, CH Projects, they're going to do it up.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of great ideas, and we'll continue our conversation on San Diego's food scene and hear about some of the best new restaurants for 2025, take a look at some dining trends all after the break. You're listening to KPBS Roundtable.
KPBS On Demand is supported by UC San Diego's Art Power, co-presenting Mayrig with Art of Elan on January 29th at The Loft. Tickets at artpower.ucsd.edu.
Welcome back to KPBS Roundtable. I'm Andrew Bracken. Today we're talking about San Diego's food and drink scene. I'm joined by San Diego food writer Helen Huang, along with journalist Jackie Bryant. Okay, so now I want to move on to, you know, some of your top food trends for 2025. And, you know, Jackie, earlier we talked a little bit about these pop-ups. Is that kind of part of a broader trend, would you say, for San Diego?
It definitely is. We were joking, you know, I'm on the San Diego Magazine podcast, and we joke there that 2025 is year of the pop-up. In fact, I think there was one point this summer where we were like, we have a moratorium on pop-up news, brick and mortars only, because it really is just such a thing. And that speaks, you know, to everything going on socially and economically here, especially since COVID. Basically, a lot of chefs, there's a lot high build-out costs, long permitting timelines, and obviously just the appeal of being able to test concepts without that pressure. It's all led to people not wanting to commit to leases. And then because there is, you know, some stalling in certain lease activity, commercial lease activity, there are a lot of properties where people are kind of just able to slide in for these fractional periods of time and try things out. So there was Pixan, which is a vegan Mexican tasting pop-up. They emphasized masa and Mexican regional cooking. Pirate Pita opened, serving a smash burger style pita hybrid, and they opened in various kitchens at various times around San Diego. Gemelos also opened. That's a Mexican Vietnamese tasting menu hosted inside of a wine shop. 24 Sons was a pop-up that became a brick and mortar in Oceanside, that's a bunch of Addison-trained chefs who also got a Michelin nod. And then I'm sure we'll talk about this in a second, but the Tony Hawk and Andrew Bachelier restaurant, Chicken Hawk, that just opened its brick and mortar after like a million years, and it was a pop-up. It grew out of that as well. So you're going to see a lot of these pop-ups just sort of end where they are, and some of them do eventually become brick and mortars. There's also two new bagel spots, Marigold and New Wave, both of which were pop-ups for many years, both of them actually, and both this past month just opened their brick and mortars in Solana Beach and North Park.
And there's another pop-up, Pop-Up Bagels, which opened in La Jolla, which actually started as a pop-up on the East Coast, and they have opened their first storefront in La Jolla, and they plan on expanding and opening like 9 other locations in San Diego.
Yeah.
So 2025, also year of the bagel.
Well, yeah, that's yes, that is actually a trend. We wrote about that at San Diego Magazine too. Forever, we've had an anemic bagel culture here.
Yeah.
San Diego. And as a native New Yorker, I can extremely claim this. And now we have an unbelievable bevy of options of great bagels around San Diego. So that is definitely a 2025 trend.
Helen, yeah. It's sort of interesting to hear, you know, I was talking about restaurants and bars and stuff and talking so much about real estate. And, you know, it's like something we, you know, associate with our housing crisis.
Yes.
But you say that is a real important part of what's happening in San Diego cuisine this year, right now?
Yes. I mean, you see, as long as in addition to the ones that Jackie mentioned, we also have like, you know, Pho Gao Ga that opened, and there was a pop-up in Crab Hut in Kingfisher. So it's the same owners, and they're testing out this whole concept of chicken pho noodle soup and seeing if that works. But there's also, like, you see some, like, people coming from ghost kitchens and opening up their storefronts. Like Relic Bakery, they had a place in Miramar, and they've just opened up their East Village, the one downtown.
Mm-hmm.
It's an amazing croissant and some bagels,
like
probably,
the best.
Yeah.
She's got the best stuff. She trained at a bakery in Copenhagen and mm-hmm. brought all of her like lamination techniques that she discovered there, and like the melding of savory pastry and sweet pastry to
yes.
open it.
She has like lamb pastries and pork pastries, which are really amazing.
And I would say building off of that, also you have a big, big trend is restaurants changing their business models because of Uber Eats and takeout. This mm-hmm. is something that happened during COVID, largely a big shift to delivery and takeout, and it is not something that has gone away in the way that remote work is still a debate out there. What to do about restaurant delivery is definitely still a debate, and you'll find many restaurants around the county, their balance sheets are based very heavily on takeout and delivery, which has completely transformed their operating models. So you have to get takeout counters, you have to redo the kitchen, your cooking techniques, how much staff you need to have, and when and how. It has to
be a larger kitchen, maybe, totally, rather than not worry
exactly.
about the tables.
And yeah. so like Terra yeah. American Bistro is one really good example over near here on the San Diego La Mesa line. And that was a restaurant that was open for 30 years that closed its dining room this year and made this shift to 100% catering based on the fact that no one's coming in for dinner anymore.
Earlier, you mentioned Tony Hawk's.
Yeah, Chicken Hawk in Leucadia and Encinitas. So they finally were able to open their own restaurant, which is fantastic. It's hot chicken, but they also have like seafood and blackened tuna and tuna tataki and just amazing dishes. And it's from Tony Hawk and Chef Andrew Bachelet, who also has Atelier Mana, and which also has a Michelin nod. And it's just it's something that they've really worked hard on opening. And they've done pop-ups at Fox Point Farms, at the Roxy in Encinitas. So they've have a lot of like friends who have supported their launch, and now they're finally open.
Is that a pretty common journey now to opening a restaurant? Is like going the pop-out route, or doing, you even mentioned a couple different pop-ups before, you know, going brick and mortar?
I think so, because it's just so prohibitively expensive to enter the market. And then there's also, There's definitely a big NIMBY, not in my backyard, culture in San Diego. Encinitas definitely has a strong culture of that. You could Google those two terms and a lot of reporting will come up. There's a lot of mixed residential and commercial areas in San Diego where you have homes very close to businesses, and there are a number of people who are very active in the public sphere challenging new alcohol licenses. This has been happening forever, but it's very popular in places like Encinitas or in North Park, for example. And so it's going to be very unattractive for somebody opening a restaurant to get a lease and then not be able to nail an alcohol license with it. That's obviously going to cut majorly into there. Yeah. So you'll find that the pop-up is a great way of testing this while maybe they're trying to actually work a deal. And sometimes it can take years to get some of those licenses if you don't buy a property that already has one transferred to you.
Yes.
You mentioned Encinitas there. I know North County is kind of went through a lot of change, right?
Yeah.
Tell us more about what you saw from Encinitas and North County more broadly. It wasn't just Encinitas, right?
Yeah. So Encinitas's food scene has just completely – I mean, North County's food scene has completely transformed. You have the North City development in San Marcos, which has been being built for decades but is really finally just opening storefronts, opening apartments. It's near CSU San Marcos.
Yes.
And a number of, like, original restaurants are opening there and also offshoots of other county enterprises.
Yes. They have, like, Christophe Rule Patisserie that just opened. Which is amazing croissants as well.
Oh, that's, I know, we are also having a bakery. There's
yeah.
a bagel renaissance and a bakery renaissance. Those are not the same, but they overlap. Mm-hmm. And then obviously you have Lilo in Carlsbad, which opened in April and I think like 40 days later got its first Michelin star. That's the effort from Chef Eric Bost, who previously owned a star at Jeune Jolie and worked in Michelin-level French kitchens and had opened a restaurant in LA just at the start of COVID. This was his big effort and it had to get shut down. And so this is his coming back to his like rightful fine dining heritage. And it's really stunning. He opened Lilo with John Resnick, a longtime local restaurateur who founded Campfire and Jeune Jolie and also came from the CH pedigree. And obviously it got a Michelin star within 40 days. So their wine program is excellent and very California focused. And the architecture is just this beautiful, natural, modern wood dining room, and it's just like a very austere, beautiful, serious, but the experience is intended to like wake you up sensorially. So it's a very cool thing that we have.
And there's a couple of other like fine dining Michelin restaurant or ones that are going to have ambitions for Michelin that opened up in La Jolla. Lucien, which is in La Jolla, and it's founded by four team members who moved from New York City who all worked in like, you know, super posh Michelin restaurants per se, Daniel. And then there's also Florette that just opened, which is, I think, the largest kitchen in San Diego, which is in La Jolla as well.
Yeah, there's a lot happening in
La Jolla Playhouse.
So we've kind of hit, you know, North County. You mentioned La Jolla. There's a lot happening there. And Convoy, of course. What about Barrio Logan? What is Barrio Logan seen in 2025?
Barrio Logan has seen a lot of change, right?
Yes.
In the last few years, you've got Fish Guts,
which
has recently reopened and is, you know, they work very closely with the region's fishermen like Tommy Gomes and Tuna Harbor Dockside Market to get like really fresh local catch in there.
Mm-hmm.
I know that that's one that's open. I know that Salud closed, which was really big news this year. There was a big to-do with that and a lot of lease arguments and what have you, but they've closed.
So and I think like a really brewery closed, too. Was it Brewery X or something?
Exactly,
closed down there. So, yeah, I think – but then there's a new one, Fonda del Barrio, that is a Mexican restaurant that is celebrating, like, indigenous dishes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's from the same Jerry Torres who opened City Tacos. So he's really trying to focus in on some more – I guess, more complex dishes that more than just like tacos. That
and of course, you have Chichi Osteria, which is in the neighborhood and beloved by the local community. They're very in tight with the local community. They just re-upped their Michelin nod. And obviously, Los Cuatro Milpas, which was billed as San Diego's oldest taqueria. That fact can be debated, but it's definitely one of the oldest. It was operated by the Estudillo family continuously since the 1930s. And unfortunately, it just closed.
Yes.
So we have about 2 minutes left. I just want to really quick, Jackie, wondering if you cover so many different food stories throughout the year. What have been some of your favorites in 2025 that stick with you?
100%. My absolute favorite food story from the year is the fact that Jason Mraz, who lives up on his farm, Mraz Family Farms up in Fallbrook, he teamed up with his longtime friend and collaborator, Valley Gilly, he bought her coffee shop and they re-upped it. And basically the story behind that is that it's been open since the early 90s, and it was one of the coffee shops where Jason got his start originally in tandem with Java Joe's down in Ocean Beach, which is also where Jewel and a lot of other singer-songwriters got their start in San Diego. And so over the years, it's been a hub for local musicians and just local people coming up to see. So bought it, they redid it, they gilded out the bathroom, redid the stage. They redid some of the food options. They have a very it's a vegan kitchen, and so now they're actually doing pop-up shows. And Jason Mraz very quietly can be known to be at some of these shows. If you see a billing, it's so and so and friends. He's the and friends. So
Nice.
There's kind of a homegrown vegan food coffee scene, guitar
music
scene
community
coming back up. Yeah. It's called Jitters. I think I just realized I didn't say the coffee name. Maybe we bought Jitters.
And we'll put a link up to that on our site. Helen, we've just a few seconds left, but I'm wondering, I don't know, any San Diego food predictions for 2026? What's on your radar?
I think we're going to see more vegetarian options that you're going to see on the menu. And what we're talking about, the non-alcoholic, dry January seems to be like starting in December, and it'll continue on. I think we're going to go to more like home style dishes. Like Bosforo is another Turkish restaurant that's opened and it's amazing. Like really,
really good.
I spent like 3 weeks in Turkey, so I'm glad they opened.
So great. Yeah. Jackie Bryant is a journalist and co-host of the Happy Half Hour podcast. And also Helen Huang has been here. She's a food writer here in San Diego. Thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you for listening to KPBS Roundtable. You can listen to the show anytime as a podcast. Want to thank our technical producer this week was Brandon Trufa, producer Ashley Rush. Thanks again. Have a great weekend.
From El Centro to everywhere, we're Voices del Valle.
Voices del Valle?
Voices del Valle is a teen-produced podcast about coming of age in California's Imperial Valley.
I love Voices del Valle.
On the next episode of Voices del Valle, we will talk with teens about their cheer and soccer championship seasons. I've got to listen to that. Voices del Valle, fresh voices, bold stories made in the valley.
Voices del Valle, find us on KPBS or wherever you get your podcasts.